This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. A group in La Crosse has been hosting an International Women's Day celebration since 2013. The event features women who live and work in the La Crosse area, but come from another country. It's a chance to learn about other cultures and how women are treated in other parts of the world compared to the U.S. This year's event will be held Sunday, March 8th at the UW La Crosse Student Union. WPR's John Davis got the chance to learn more about the event. He sat down with Lois Gilbert, who's chair of the event's planning committee, and Lema Kabashi, who's an associate professor of special education in the Department of Educational Studies at UW La Crosse. Lema is from Kosovo and is a panelist at this year's event.
So, Lois, I want to start with you. Why is La Crosse a good place to celebrate International Women's Day?
La Crosse is not diverse. We can all agree on that. La Crosse has had recent episodes of racist incidents, and the community has come together over those. We have an administration right now that has taken a different approach on immigrants and refugees, and yet we're a nation built by immigrants. So we started this event in 2013 with two sponsoring organizations, AAUW and UW La Crosse Department of International Education and Engagement. And now we have 14 sponsors. We have 12 other community organizations. And our crowd size has gone from 50 to close to 250. So it has shown us that we have people who want to meet the neighbors in our community who maybe they don't know.
The theme for this year's event around the world is hashtag Each for Equal, which I know has something to do with social media. But what does that mean? What are we celebrating this year with that as a theme?
I think we are celebrating this year that each of us needs to work towards gender equity. Whatever our gender identity is, we are all in the same race with the same color blood, and we each have a stake in making the world more inclusive.
Lema, you are serving as a panelist this year at the event. What is your story? Could you, I don't need to go back to birth, but how does one get from growing up in Kosovo to coming to the United States?
First of all, I want to say that it's an honor to represent women of Kosovo, and we have a long history and all as a country, but also, my country is kind of the newest country in the world because we became independent only 12 years ago. So we just celebrated our 12th anniversary of independence. Growing up in Kosovo, really as a woman, I would say that it wasn't only, you know, changes or differences being a woman. It was being an Albanian woman because Kosovo suffered from oppression from Serbia as a country, and as a result of that, my youth, instead of being in schools and doing, you know, what youth will do, it was mostly filled with protests in the streets for equal and human rights, and also really trying to survive, surviving from gas poisoning in schools because schools were segregated, Albanians in the afternoons and Serbs in the morning. And when school buildings were only frequented with Albanian students, then they poured sarin gas in schools. So I was one of the people or students at that time that suffered from the student poisoning too. Then after, you know, high school, I started college, and on September 3rd, 1991, we had this massive protest, and all Albanians were in the streets protesting for, again, human rights, and everybody who was part of that protest was fired from jobs, was kicked out from schools. So we thought that that was just temporary. How can they do that for, you know, the whole country? But it wasn't just temporary. It lasted 10 years. And in 1999, as you probably know a little bit about the history of my country, there was a war, conflict in Kosovo, and until June 1999, when NATO troops actually won, then Serbia withdrew troops from Kosovo and finally became liberated. But it was still under international protectorate. So Kosovo didn't become an independent country until 2008.
When did you come to America?
I had a chance to come in 2005 because I was part of the University of Pristina, where I studied and then I started working there as an assistant. And there is a different position. It's called assistant professor, but it's not equal to assistant professor here. But still, it is that rank that you have to kind of go in the university there. And I started coming here in more in the capacity of people, young people who were trying to reform a system of education in Kosovo. And I was one of the team members from those two groups. I came in 2005 two times at the University of Pittsburgh. And that was really the time when I found a passion for special education, because we were showing more like places where you can see education, how it works, not only in schools, but also in higher education. And that's when I had a chance to go to University of Pittsburgh, but also Slippery Rock University. And I found how we can help students with disabilities. And that was it. That was when I found that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I did complete a master's degree at the Slippery Rock University. Then in 2007, I started my PhD at the University of Pittsburgh in special education, specifically early intervention. And I graduated from University of Pittsburgh, and the first time that I actually applied in higher education was here in La Crosse.
So you leave Kosovo before independence?
Yes.
What was life like, not only for women, but all, everybody? I mean, when you left, what was life like?
Kosovo was destroyed after the war. So I was actually teaching last night. One of my students was talking about, you know, setting events, we call it, because my class is about behaviors. And one of the setting events, one of the case studies, was power went off and this person didn't have coffee and then he was really upset. So I said, you know, the setting event is not something that happens frequently. So I was trying to explain. I said, if you are in Kosovo, that might happen, because after the war, power was frequent. So we had 2 hours that we had power, and then 4 hours didn't have power. That was because the country was really in the ruins. And after we came back, because as part of, you know, I shared the fate with my people in my country, and we were, because of ethnic cleansing, we were in Montenegro, my family and myself, and a lot of Albanians were all over the place in other neighboring countries. But we still returned to Kosovo, and we started rebuilding the country. But it was hard. That's why I said that we came in the capacity of young people who wanted to reform the system of education. But because Kosovo didn't have special education at that time, and even now doesn't have a department of special education in the whole country, then my contribution is more if I work here and help my fellow counterparts there than if I go and don't really have anything, you know, where I can contribute, because we still don't have a special education department there.
So when you left Kosovo, were things equally as bad for men and women, or?
Yes, because we just shared the same fate. It wasn't about what religion, or Albanians, they are three different religions, but there was never an issue. Albanians don't have that, you know, discrepancy between what religion you have. It was always fighting for the, you know, survival, because being an Albanian, it was something that people, you know, I would say in the fight against Serbs was that oppression. Serbia wanted to, you know, to oppress Albanians. Not, it wasn't between, you know, Albanians or those, you know, fights between Albanians. It was against two different countries, I would say.
Lois, I know that human trafficking is a cause this year at the La Crosse event. What is happening with that, around that?
Well, the experts in sex trafficking in La Crosse are the FSPA. Sister Marlene Weisenbeck has come and spoken with AAUW, and she was actually appointed by President Obama to receive national training on sex trafficking. The reference we're using for that to tie into International Women's Day is that AAUW will be doing a collection of new and gently used bras. The initiative is called Free the Girls, and people can donate these as they attend our International Women's Day event. This is to help women who are former sex trafficking victims in El Salvador, Mozambique, and Costa Rica. This is to start them to have something to sell, to have an income so they are not as financially exploitable as if they weren't having any income. So this is to help sex trafficking victims in these countries reintegrate into their communities.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We're talking about this year's International Women's Day celebration set for Sunday, March 8th in the UW La Crosse Student Union. Our guests are Dr. Lema Kabashi of Kosovo. She is one of the panelists at this year's event and is an associate professor of special education in the Department of Educational Studies at UW La Crosse. We're also talking with Lois Gilbert with the American Association of University Women La Crosse. She is the chair of the planning committee for the event. Lima, I'm curious, could you compare the rights for women in Kosovo with women in the United States?
One thing that I want to mention is that Kosovo is a developing country. So if nothing else, that might tell that there are differences between, you know, women's rights in Kosovo and women's rights in the U.S. However, we are really fighting hard as women in the country that here and there to fight for our rights. And in Kosovo, we just had elections just a few months ago, and among 15 ministers in the government, five of them are women. And the Speaker of the House is a woman, too. She is actually one of the graduates from the University of Pittsburgh, which is my alma mater, and I'm really proud of her. And also, historically, you know, Kosovars, Albanians, because Kosovo was part of Albania, so Albanian is the term that I would use more going back into history, that we really have... It's more like traditional Albanian law that they respected women. So if we look back in history, women were always respected. And it was kind of, I would say that if you touched a woman, that means that you had to fight with the whole tribe. So it wasn't something that you could take it lightly. But in days, I think that women in Kosovo, they are fighting for their own rights, and there is this movement that, like here, you know, women want to have the right for education and the free speech. And when I was growing up, that was a little bit hard because my generation, education wasn't as easy to be really attained for many reasons. And one was that it was unsafe because of the oppression in the country. So a lot of families might not have had that opportunity to provide the education. And also because of the developing country, Kosovo didn't have the means to really afford, you know, because of financial crisis, to afford maybe educating their children. And especially when they had to pick between woman and man, they probably would go with man because still the society has those biases. Man is still favored over woman. And I think, especially in rural areas, that was a big issue. So now these are, now in recent years, things have changed. And I think that it's still a fight that is not won, but it is a battle that we are working on.
So because independence is fairly new. I mean, it's not like life is better for women now than it would have been, say, 200 or 300 years ago if you were, you know, becoming an independent state then.
I think women's life is better now. I have actually a pretty good case. One of my sisters-in-law, she got married and she had only her elementary school finished because elementary school is compulsory in Kosovo, but high school and college is not. So she married, that's the tradition. So you are a beautiful girl and you go marry and have a good life. But she wasn't happy with that. So after she had two children, her oldest son and her graduated from college just last spring. So it's just that more opportunities and really more. My family is a lot into education. So last spring, 7 members of my family graduated from college or master's degree. And she's one of them, which is a good example that women, if they are determined and they have right place to just flourish, then they are going to do that. And there are so many young women that they want to improve and progress. But also, I think the government has to do their part because they have to give, you know, women the means to be able to fight for their own rights.
I'm going to ask this both of you. Are we making progress when it comes to women's rights around the world, do you think, in the last 10, 20 years? Or since this has started, you know, in La Crosse, recognizing International Women's Day?
I think we have more interest in it. This event on March 8th is not the only international event in La Crosse. There are numerous ones. The People's Food Co-op has one every year, which is related to women in food, women farmers, women food providers. I think of it as 2 steps forward, 1 step back. We have Virginia, who has ratified the Equal Rights Amendment, but there's all kinds of court filings against implementing that. I think we're making progress, but we still have a long way to go, specifically in getting women into more elected positions.
Lim, what are your views?
Compared to 20 years ago, you said, I think that, yes, we are doing much better. I could say that we are doing much better than 10 years ago. I am here 20 years ago. When I compare my life, I was in Kosovo, and I was, you know, trying to survive there. But now here, I am just, this is just opportunity. And I think if women are giving more opportunities, and that is a good sign, because we just, we don't want pity. We just want equal opportunities. Mm-hmm. And if we have those opportunities, we're going to grab that chance. We're not going to let go. And that's, I think, that is just the case for all women all around the world, because in a lot of cases, women are seen as just a number to fill the seat, but we shouldn't be seen that way. We have the capacity to really do what men do, and it's just we need a chance. So I think that, yes, we are given more chances, but also we are grabbing those chances, even if they are not just handed to us. We are showing that we can do it.
Mm-hmm. Lois, could you give the details of this year's event, please?
Yes, John. And I want to say, I could listen to Lima all day. And Lima is one of 4 panelists. So you will also be meeting on March 8th Dr. Wawa Toon, who is an structural and interventional cardiologist at Gunderson Health System. You'll be meeting Myra Sarfraz, who's in financial services at Marine Credit Union. And you'll be meeting Anya Meyer from Poland, and they all have compelling stories. This is a free event on Sunday, March 8th. It begins at 1 o'clock with light refreshments. The second floor of the UWL Student Union. Parking will be free in the Cleary lot, and also in the ramp closest to the student union. The program starts promptly at 1:30 with some opening remarks, and then you will hear from each of the four panelists. They will share their journey. They will talk about gender equity between their home country and their adopted country. And we will have a question and answer period following that for audience questions. There will be a selfie booth so you can pose with hashtag each for equal. And it will be a good celebration of the cultural, the political, the economic successes of women around the world. So please come and meet the neighbors you haven't met for international women from the La Crosse area.
Lois Gilbert is chair of the committee planning the March 8th International Women's Day celebration at UW-La Crosse, and Lema Kobashi is a panelist at this year's event. She's originally from Kosovo and is currently an associate professor of special education in the Department of Educational Studies at UW-La Crosse. They spoke with WPR's John Davis. Coming up, we'll talk to a history professor about the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage movement and Wisconsin's role in the movement. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, WPR.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at WPR.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. This year is the 100th anniversary of the women's suffrage movement, which led to the 19th Amendment and giving women the right to vote. To celebrate the anniversary this month, the La Crosse Area Chapter of the League of Women Voters hosted an emeritus history professor from the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point to talk about the history of the women's suffrage movement here in Wisconsin. WPR's Ezra Wall has this interview with Teresa Kaminsky.
Dr. Kaminsky, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. I really appreciate the invitation.
So, getting the vote for women, August of 1920 is when it happened officially, but it was a big movement leading up to that. What was the social climate like in the era when that movement was going on in the United States?
Well, it took a very long time, so I guess the what the United States was like itself changed very much from the beginning of the process, which most scholars would put at 1848. So by the time you get all the way to 1920, the United States has undergone a whole lot of changes, and I think some of those changes are probably rooted in the suffrage movement itself, the long-term push for not only women's voting rights, but other rights for women as well.
So the effort in the United States, how did that compare to other parts of the Western world? Maybe the society we might most easily compare ourselves to as far as those of us of European descent, England, they had their own suffrage movement at a certain point. Is this a similar timeline, or did ours come later?
There was a very similar timeline with England. I was just looking at a map earlier today of women's suffrage around the world, and the United States certainly didn't come in first, and they didn't come in last. So this is certainly a worldwide or global phenomenon that's taken root in different times and different places. But the movement in England was very much overlapping with the United States, and in fact, some notable American suffragists got a lot of inspiration, whether directly or indirectly, from the movement that was going on in England. If you think of women, especially like Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who started really pushing for that constitutional amendment in the United States, they'd both been radicalized by their involvement in the British movement.
Changing the Constitution, speaking of that, is no small feat. It takes a lot of effort and across oftentimes many, many years. And for a group to undertake that, which is completely disenfranchised at the time that they're trying to effect this change, how did they make progress, or how did they get the rest of society who could vote, essentially the white men of society, to buy into their movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a couple of things. One is that putting the emphasis on a constitutional amendment for women's voting rights was not the first method that women embraced. It was originally conceived of as a state-by-state effort. Voting rights until the 14th and 15th Amendments had been at the discretion of the states. Individual states decide who their voters are. So women understood this. They understood politics. They understood history. So they were operating mostly at the state levels. You get out and get supporters in the legislature, and you get new laws at the state level. And before 1920, there had been some success with that. So even prior to the passage of the 19th Amendment, some women in different places in the United States could vote. But they couldn't all vote in all elections, and of course, they couldn't all vote across the United States. So that's why by about the time Alice Paul got involved with the National American Woman Suffrage Association, that's why the emphasis shifted from a state-by-state campaign to a constitutional campaign.
So whether we're talking about the state-by-state effort or the effort toward a national constitutional amendment, certainly each state had its advocates, and Wisconsin is no exception there. Let's talk about who the major players were in Wisconsin who were promoting the right to have women become enfranchised.
Right, and there are some notable names. Some of the initial activism actually came out of a rather small town in southwestern Wisconsin called Richland Center. And that's where David James, who was for a time a Wisconsin state senator, and he lived there with his wife, Laura. And they were both very much involved in sort of 19th century reform. Throughout the state of Wisconsin in the 19th century, a lot of activism undertaken by both men and women focused on temperance, which was trying to stop the consumption of alcohol, which we all know ultimately resulted in the 18th Amendment. So women were particularly attracted to the temperance movement because they saw it as their right to protect their families. And they did believe that alcohol consumption was a bad thing and that it threatened the sanctity of the family. So between that temperance activism and abolition in the decades prior to the Civil War, there were many people in Wisconsin who had that kind of reformist bent. Mm-hmm. And it did appear that the Jameses were part of this. And by the 1880s, Laura James had decided the time had really come to revive a state suffrage association that had been kind of languishing for a few years since the 1870s and really helped to get it started again. Also in the same time period, you have Olympia Brown, who was, I think, one of the first female ordained ministers, and she had a congregation in Racine. And she was very much committed to women's suffrage, and she was one of the leaders of the Wisconsin Women's Suffrage Association, and even tested a state law about women in Wisconsin in 1869 received the right to vote in school board elections. And Olympia Brown wanted to test how broadly that could be construed. And she tried to vote in municipal-wide elections, arguing that all local laws had an impact on education. So women should be able to vote in all local elections. But the state Supreme Court shot that argument down. So these were the kinds of things that women were doing in the state of Wisconsin through most of the 19th century, really focusing on changes to state laws.
Did Olympia Brown and Laura James know each other?
I think so. I think probably Olympia Brown was even better acquainted with the James's daughter, Ada James, who in the 1890s and then through the last fight for suffrage, Ada James really took the reins, even with the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association, moving it into the more modern period and really utilizing that slogan, Votes for Women. She had suffrage supporters out in those new automobiles, and she arranged for leaflets to be dropped from airplanes, and she was really one of the architects behind the 1912 suffrage referendum in the state of Wisconsin. Ada James worked with her father, who I think was out of office by that time, but was still very influential. And they finally got the state legislature to agree to have this referendum held, which lost by a huge margin. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, how do you convince people to support this? And of course, when the referendum was put to voters in Wisconsin, the only voters in Wisconsin at the time were men. And the fact that some men, and it was not even 40%, but some male voters did support the suffrage referendum, but that wasn't enough to get it to carry. And I think it just really did indicate how strong traditional beliefs about women's place in the home still held on into the early 20th century.
I wanted to ask about that because indeed the fight for equality for women and even the fight for equality among all people, among all sorts of gender identities now, as we're seeing, is far from over. But really in a way that seems foreign to us now. Women were not part of the leadership of society, and it was really out of the ordinary for people to suggest that they should be allowed to vote, allowed to, in many cases, work outside the home, allowed to play a leadership role in their communities.
Right. And it was, it all kind of went together. The movement for women's suffrage was part of a broader movement for women's rights. I don't think anybody just assumed at that point that women's suffrage was the only thing that women needed, but more broadly based women's rights, which included things like property rights. Most people today, I mean, can hardly conceive of the idea that once a woman got married, she no longer had the legal right to her own salary. If she worked outside of the home, her salary belonged to her husband. Any property she brought into the marriage, whether it was real estate or the clothes on her back, it all belonged to her husband. So part of the early women's rights movement dealt with getting states to change those married women's property rights. And Wisconsin did that fairly early on, I think in 1850. So there was a recognition that that was an issue. Getting women into colleges and universities, first at the undergraduate level, then for graduate training. Most medical schools, law schools kept women out. in some cases into the 20th century. So this was all part of that fight to see women as equal human beings with men, and it still brings up many of the same issues we're discussing today. What does that mean for home and family? One of the biggest arguments against women's suffrage was that it would corrupt women, that politics was dirty business, and that women, their refined natures would just not be conducive to being involved with politics.
So in a lot of parts of the country, and this certainly a state-by-state issue and really in a lot of ways a north-south issue, but in a lot of parts of the country, the fight for the vote for women really was the fight for the vote for white women.
Yes.
What about Wisconsin? Where does Wisconsin fall in that spectrum?
Well, as I was reacquainting myself with the local history, because most of my work on this has been more at the national level, I think Wisconsin kind of fell somewhere in the middle. I didn't find too many egregious racial problems, and by egregious, I mean that's not saying that there weren't any. Wisconsin had a strong abolitionist heritage, but I think a lot of people today realize that the abolitionist movement was not necessarily one that promoted a true racial equality. It was one thing to end slavery. It was quite another thing to promote racial equality. And I think most white people in Wisconsin were still very sensitive to that. And there was also the issue in Wisconsin about Native Americans and what that meant in terms of citizenship and voting rights. But I think in general, the women's suffrage movement in Wisconsin was probably no more or no less welcoming to women of color than its other counterparts in the North. Southern states, of course, were much more explicit in their exclusion of women of color, and that did permeate into the national movement as well. So the story there is not a particularly good one. It's one that the legacy of the women's suffrage movement really has to deal with, and I think scholars have been trying to confront that more head on. I mean, even some of the women that we tend to revere in the women's suffrage movement, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, made some powerful arguments for excluding people of color from voting rights in favor of white women. And it's so hard and so disappointing to read those kinds of things now.
We look at these things through our modern lens, but is with the ability to kind of go back in time a little bit and observe some of those ideas that were promoted, is there any notion that they might have been willing to allow some of these exceptions because that's how they advanced the issue and they knew that pushing the racial side of it more strongly would be a turnoff to the people that they needed to support their movement?
I think that's one of the justifications that's often floated, was that it would be too hard to pull everybody in this direction if it's asking for too much. But, you know, we hear that argument so much. And for it to be true, it would have meant that all suffragists believe this. And that wasn't true. I mean, if you look at women like Lucy Stone, who often disagreed with Stanton and Susan B. Anthony about suffrage issues, including their concepts about race. Lucy Stone was maybe a bit more progressive. She did support wholeheartedly the 14th and 15th Amendments, which provided voting rights for African American men. And in her case, she said that was perfectly justifiable. That was right because of slavery. And she said in that case, once you have voting rights for black men, then you can start bringing in other groups of people. So it I guess it all depends on where you're willing to put your emphasis. Certainly Stanton and Anthony had a lot of supporters, but so did Lucy Stone. So that possibility was always out there for an all-inclusive movement. And actually for a while, for a very brief while, even Stanton and Anthony tried their hardest to promote what they referred to as equal suffrage, that everybody over the age of 21 gets to vote, no matter race, gender, everybody gets to vote. When they read the language of the 14th Amendment and realized where this was all going, that's when they realized that that equal suffrage was not going to work for them. Other people held on to that for a longer time and did see equal suffrage as a real possibility, but it didn't work.
When I was growing up, my first exposure to the issue of suffrage for women and the whole movement back culminating in 1920 was the Susan B. Anthony dollar, because
right.
there was a dollar coin that was produced, you know, way back in the Stone Ages that had Susan B. Anthony on it, and I was running up to my mother and my grandmother, and who is this on the dollar coin? And they would tell me about her. How did the movement in Wisconsin interact in any way with national figures like Susan B. Anthony and others?
Yes, it did, and it very much depended on scheduling and the practicalities of travel. And I was having this conversation earlier today about just the dedication of these women who would travel around different parts of the country to promote suffrage. And in 1869, when the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association was first founded, both Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were here in the state, and they were traveling around and giving talks about suffrage, and so they were very much helping to get this statewide movement going. And the Wisconsin Woman Suffrage Association did for a time ally itself more closely with Stanton and Anthony. A little bit later on, they were worried about the increasing radicalism of those two women, but especially Stanton. And incidentally, that's why we get a Susan B. Anthony dollar and not a Elizabeth Cady Stanton dollar, because to put Stanton's picture on a coin raises all sorts of issues. And Stanton was much more controversial, not only because of her issues about race, but she was considered to be a religious radical. She actually rewrote the Bible she took great exception to the way men had written the Bible.
Okay.
So she wrote her own version. And she also had some very, for the time, very radical views about divorce, in that women should be allowed to pursue divorce. So she really was considered to be a radical. Susan B. Anthony, not so much.
In terms of some of her racial ideas, maybe not up to speed with what we would think of now, but in some of her other ideas, really ahead of her time.
Right, right. And I think that the main part of the women's movement probably didn't quite know what to make of her, that as she, and you know, this does happen with people as they grow older, sometimes they do grow more radical, and that seemed to happen with her. As she advanced in age, she just really came out with all sorts of interesting ideas, and it's even more fascinating when you realize that this is a woman who married at not a young age, but when it was considered acceptable for women to get married. She had 7 children. So she was very much a family person, but she had very clear ideas about what was right and what was wrong in terms of gender relations. And the older she got, the less willing she was to hedge on any of that.
Were there efforts in regards to women's suffrage to repress the vote of women once they did have the actual legal right to vote, like there have been in, like we think of the repression efforts against African Americans or others?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example of that, and I can't really think of anything. And this may tie into, as you said, kind of concerns after 1920, when the 19th Amendment was ratified. Everybody was wondering, well, what's going to happen? How are election results going to change now that women have the right to vote? And one of the things that had kind of held back women's suffrage from being successful, especially at the state levels, was women's involvement in temperance, because the liquor interests wanted to prevent women from voting because they assumed that once women had the right to vote, that prohibition would come in and they would all be out of business. And the timing, of course, was a little bit off, because prohibition gets passed before the suffrage amendment. So you can't put that all on women voting. And actually, what happens once women start voting in 1920 is that the results of how those votes played out, I think, more clearly showed that gender really didn't play a part in how they voted. Women were more influenced by other social and cultural factors. What was their class? What was their race? What's their religion? Those things seem to matter more than, oh, I'm a woman and I'm voting. So I think that kind of big gender change didn't happen, but at least through much of the 1920s, I think both major political parties thought that it still could happen. So there was much more cultivation of women as voters and as potential politicians. And we do see almost immediately after 1920 women angling to get into elected office. They were figuring out ways to run for office, get appointed to office. They really saw participation, direct participation in politics, as another form of expressing their citizenship rights.
I know that as a historian, you know a lot more about what has already happened than about what is happening now. But how does your study of this issue, how does that affect the way that you see the current developments in particularly American politics now 100 years after suffrage for women?
I think it kind of plays into my pessimism that much will change. If we look at the gender makeup in Congress, we know that women are not represented there as much as they should be, especially in the Senate. We see women lagging behind. And in terms of presidential candidates, this is still a problem. And it's just really interesting that we've had hundreds of years of male presidents, some of them better than others, and yet voters are always willing to give another man another chance. And this does not seem to hold true for women who are in public office, and I still think it's going to take a very long time. So 100 years really is nothing in terms of change. And I think what we're seeing now is just how much we still have yet to do, that any sort of movement is ongoing, and it's not finished, and it's not, okay, so this has all been accomplished, let's do something else. I don't think it's ever time to stop.
Well, it may not be, but it is our time to stop.
And that was a great segue.
with that, let me thank you for being here. Teresa Kaminsky is the Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Professor Kaminsky, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That's Ezra Wall, the new regional manager of WPR's La Crosse Bureau, who will soon be the new host of Newsmakers. Ezra will take over the show later in March. And that's it for Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview on the International Women's Day celebration in La Crosse, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.